even if you can't change the material circumstances of a person's life when they're both poor and depressed, improving their mental health through mental health interventions can actually help them regain some economic well-being.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Mental illness is far more common than most of us acknowledge. At the moment, between 3 and 4% of the world's population is suffering from depression, and about the same number from anxiety, and the poor are twice as likely to suffer as the rich. Yet we still underspend on treating mental health. And we know comparatively little, on one hand, about how poverty affects mental health, or on the other hand, how investment in treating problems like anxiety and depression could help reduce poverty. A new paper investigates both of these complex relationships, and Vikram Patel of Harvard Medical School is one of the authors. He joins me today. Vikram, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Tim.
How badly, Vikram, do we under-resource treatment for mental illness?
Well, pretty badly, no matter which country you live in. All countries disproportionately underspend on mental health in their healthcare budgets when one considers the proportion of the overall burden of disease that can be attributed to mental and substance use conditions. And in this sense, all countries are developing when it comes to mental health.
Is the disparity worse in developing countries?
Yes, of course, the disparity is much worse for two reasons. Firstly, of course, the overall healthcare budgets are much smaller on the per capita basis, but also that healthcare budget has to be spent on many more health conditions that more developed countries perhaps don't have to deal with anymore. For example, maternal and child health conditions. And so there is a much greater pressure on those scarce resources from conditions which are considered to be priorities because they are likely to kill more people, and mental health suffers even more in those settings.
This paper that you have written focuses in on depression and anxiety. Can you define exactly what those are and how people in developing countries might experience them?
One of the great challenges in conversations about depression and anxiety as a mental health condition is that they're also completely normal human emotional responses to all kinds of things that happen in our lives. For example, grief, loss, or, you know, being attacked on the street by a robber. And so the question is, how do you distinguish the normative human response to loss, grief, and all these other difficulties in our lives from the mental health condition? And it has to be admitted that there isn't a very clear hard line that distinguishes these. And that's been one of the problems that, you know, oftentimes people see depression, anxiety as something that's a natural reaction rather than a mental health condition. The way in the mental health professional field we distinguish these two is that we consider them qualitatively different from everyday sadness and misery by virtue of the pervasiveness of the experiences of depression. I'll focus on that for now. For example, the number of different domains of our emotional life, the way we behave, the way we think, the way we feel, the pervasiveness of the effects of this condition on all these different experiences, the impact that this has on our daily functioning, the ability of us to actually pull ourselves out of that funk, and the duration with which it lasts. And I think it's therefore this constellation of other features that one has to take into account when we consider depression as a mental health condition as opposed to the misery of everyday life.
Now, mental health is multidimensional, as is poverty. So the relationship between them is complicated. Might this be why there is comparatively little research into that relationship?
Yes, it's absolutely the case that these are both, fairly complex concepts. And to study the relationship between two complex concepts is not very attractive for most people. You know, but that said, you know, poverty has been very widely studied as a social determinant of other health outcomes. But again, those health outcomes tend to be much more, as it were, simpler to measure and understand, like mortality, as opposed to depression, which is a very personal experience that is fairly difficult to assess in the sense that one has to actually conduct interviews or use questionnaires with people rather than count the number of people who've died. So yes, it is more complex. But the other reason I'll tell you is that it goes back to my earlier point, which is, well, if you're poor, the chances are your life is pretty miserable. And therefore, what's the point of asking you if you're miserable? Isn't that a kind of a given if you're poor? And what are we going to learn that is actually going to be of any value by finding out that poor people have miserable lives?
Yes. Let's look then at that relationship, the one going from poverty to depression and anxiety. What specific mechanisms around poverty do you single out as causing poor mental health?
So firstly, one has to start off by acknowledging that poverty does not directly cause depression. You know, clearly poverty acts through multiple pathways in the same kind of way that poverty doesn't directly cause tuberculosis. But one has to ask the question, what are the known risk factors of a particular health condition that are more likely to be experienced by people who live in conditions of poverty? And then when one really unpacks the question in that way, one sees a huge number of possible pathways. Consider just a few. Number one, we know that noisy environments or polluted environments affect your mental health negatively. We know that living in neighborhoods where there's a lot of violence affects your mental health negatively. We know that having chronic physical health problems and disabilities affects your mental health negatively. We know that insecurity, and not by insecurity, I don't just mean economic insecurity, but the insecurity of life and limb, humiliation and indignity are all powerful predictors of poor mental health. So if you just think of this basket of different risk factors, all of these are far more likely to be experienced by people living in conditions of poverty. And so you can begin to see why the often observed increased risk of depression and anxiety in poorer people might be explained by any one or more of these different pathways.
And looking at it on the upside, there is evidence in the economics literature that sudden positive changes in income, I know that lottery wins is something that has been studied, has a positive effect on mental health. Is it really that simple, though?
No, I don't think it is. You know, the lottery effect has been studied quite a bit, actually. And I think, again, it goes back to my earlier remarks about distinguishing normative human responses to everyday events from mental health problems. So it is absolutely the case that if I won the jackpot, that yes, I will feel really thrilled about that. There's, you know, it'll be impossible to imagine any other human reaction. That's a natural human reaction. But whether that is a sustained effect that actually protects you from mental health problems like depression, I don't believe there's any evidence that that is the case.
Looking at it more rigorously then, RCTs now do tend to look for the effect of financial interventions like cash transfers on the well-being of the people that are receiving them. Is the evidence there that an increase in income can affect your mental health positively stronger?
First of all, we need to acknowledge that when most people do these sorts of economic intervention randomized control trials, that primary outcome of interest is in mental health. So if they do measure mental health, it's almost always as a secondary outcome. And so there's actually a very limited evidence base in which economic interventions have been evaluated with that outcome. And they've been rarely statistically powered to look at mental health outcomes because it's almost always an exploratory or secondary outcome. So with that caveat in mind, yes, wherever people have looked for the impacts on mental health, in spite of those methodological limitations that I mentioned, the general picture is that there is an improvement in mental health. But because the statistical power is limited, whether that translates into a reduction in the actual burden of clinically significant depression in the population, you know, I think the jury is out, but I wouldn't be surprised with sustained economic interventions that we would in fact see a reduction in the burden of depression.
So let's turn this around. How does poor mental health cause poverty?
So there are many pathways. Again, you know, this is one thing we haven't recognized often enough in terms of policy. We've often thought it to be a natural that the association between poverty and depression is because people lead miserable lives when you're poor. But actually, the fact that when you are depressed, you're more likely to slide into economic difficulties or even poverty has been much less recognized. Obviously, this is an important pathway. If it is indeed the case that that is true, then it would suggest that even if you can't change the material circumstances of a person's life when they're both poor and depressed, improving their mental health through mental health interventions can actually help them regain some economic well-being. So therefore, it's a case for investment in mental health care. And in fact, we do have very, very strong evidence that that is indeed the case. So there are two pathways that I want to emphasize. The first pathway is due to the very disabling consequences of depression on people's ability to function productively, whether they're in education or whether they're in the employment workplace. We now know that the number of days that people take on sick leave is directly associated with how depressed they are. And so in economies where not being able to work has a direct implication on your wages because of daily wage labor, for example, well, that's a direct impact on reduced earnings. The second important pathway is because depression is often not recognized by healthcare services for what it is, people often doctor shop, they often have unnecessary medical investigations and unnecessary medical treatments. And in the poorest parts of the world, that is often in the private sector. And so that is all out of pocket. And that's a second kind of impoverishment due to health expenditure that is directly the consequence of inadequate mental health services.
And considering, again, how important the impact is on individuals and the economic impact and the impact on their families and the people that they live with, it does seem surprising that there is so little research on this.
It is. I mean, I think the fact that depression as a condition that is actually inequitably distributed in the population, in many ways, one could argue it's a disease of poverty as much as TB is, has been not fully recognized because, of course, depression also occurs amongst the wealthy. It isn't the case, unlike TB, that you don't see depression in the upper quintile of the income distribution. You do see depression across the different income quintiles. It's just that it's much more concentrated in the lowest quintiles. But the fact that it occurs in all quintiles has often led people to believe that this is actually not really a problem, particularly of poor people. The other reason why people haven't really studied depression is because the sense has been that this is a condition that requires very expensive, long-term therapies. Often the image that people get is of psychological therapies that may take a long, long period of time and are very expensive. And so even if this was a condition that affected poor people more, we really couldn't afford to actually deliver this kind of care to poor people. So why bother studying it?
More research on this does seem to have some urgency as well, because we have factors like climate change, the increase in inequality that we're seeing in many places in the world, and of course, piled on top of that now, the impact of COVID-19. They are bound to have an impact on the mental health of the poor in the near future, aren't they?
Absolutely. Not least because the numbers of the absolutely poor are going to increase astronomically in the coming months and years. It's already estimated that tens of millions of people in India alone are going to slide into poverty. In fact, I read somewhere that the gains that have been made in poverty reduction over the last decade are likely to be wiped out in the next year. And of course, if you generalize this to the rest of the world, there is going to be a huge increase in the numbers of absolutely poor. And at the same time, there's also going to be a huge increase in income inequality, because obviously some sections of society, the ones that have historically always been disadvantaged, are going to suffer disproportionately more than those who are at the wealthy end of the spectrum. So I think we should expect a surge of mental health problems led by depression. And here I'm reminded of the terrific work by Angus Deaton, the Nobel Prize winning economist, who documented the increase in mortality, premature mortality, and falling life expectancy in working age Americans after the 2008 financial recession, which he showed were largely driven by suicide and substance use related mortality. Well, we should expect a far worse economic recession in the years ahead, and therefore a far worse mental health crisis facing the world.
Yes, you're in India at the moment, I believe, aren't you? Is this something that you already see around you?
Absolutely. There has been a growing concern amongst community-based livelihood organizations. I'm being approached all the time by organizations that previously would never have even talked about mental health. But they're now looking at the mental health issues amongst the tens of millions of people who are returning back to their rural homes, having left the cities because of the lockdown, and finding that the overwhelming concerns that they have are to do with emotional distress. And so now they're turning to me and saying, how do we respond? And of course, you know, the response has to be in a much more organized way, supported by the state. But at the moment, of course, the state also has no attention on mental health because all its energies and resources are focused on containing the pandemic.
For this paper, one of the interesting things about it is it's interdisciplinary, and it really reads that way. Your co-authors are economists, you're a psychiatrist. How important is it for economists to be collaborating with other disciplines, listening to what they have to say?
Well, I'd speak not just for economists to be collaborating with other disciplines, but for all disciplines to be collaborating with one another. As a psychiatrist, I would say this is equally true of my own academic community. I think when one is dealing with such complex human and social constructs like poverty, and depression, to view these constructs solely through the prism of your own discipline is to miss most of the picture. And I think this is one of the fundamental reasons why we still understand mental health so poorly, in spite of billions of dollars of investment, is because the general focus has been on a single approach to understand mechanisms. Either it's your neural circuits, or it's your social environment, or some other thing. What we do need is to embrace the fact that the human mind is influenced by a multiplicity of pathways acting in concert: our genetic inheritance, our neurodevelopmental biology, the environments we experience from early childhood all the way into our working age life. And to actually view our minds through only one of these prisms is to lose the complexity that we need to really understand mental health much better.
You did mention that there are some interventions that do work, and comparatively low-cost interventions that do work. If you were a policymaker in India, for example, today, what policy interventions would give you hope that we could improve the situation?
Well, I'd say this is a policy intervention that applies across the world, not just the poorest countries in the world, but everywhere, that we do need to demedicalize our emphasis on mental health care. While it is absolutely the case that some individuals, some people will need mental health professional services delivered in hospitals and clinics, the vast majority of the burden of population mental health problems can be addressed by appropriately trained and supervised frontline providers that can range from one context to the other. In India, those will be community health workers. In the US, it might be nurses or primary care workers. Wherever you go, there is a whole army of frontline providers providing general health care. This is the workforce that needs to be fully empowered to deliver psychological and social interventions as the first point of care, a mental health care system that is focused on the community and the population rather than on the specialist healthcare system.
Do you see enough to give you cause for optimism, or are you worried about the future?
I am worried a little bit, Tim, because, you know, I remember in the late 1990s when the first global burden of disease report was published, when to the surprise of everyone, including the World Bank, which actually commissioned that initial first report, depression turned out to be the leading cause of the years lived with disability. And, you know, people were shocked. They didn't expect that. And so I remember being invited to the bank to speak to these economists about what could be done. And they were very excited by what was then very early evidence that, you know, community-based providers could be trained to deliver mental health care. But of course, 2000 came along and there was no mention of mental health in the Millennium Development Goals, which became the framework for all economic development globally. Now, 2015 and the SDGs that replaced the MDGs has got mental health explicitly included. The UN Secretary General has made mental health one of his priority themes. But my worry is, here we are, COVID-19 means all other health issues are now being ignored. And of course, mental health is always going to be right at the back end of the queue. So I do worry about that, but I hope that given that this time round, there is a much greater recognition of the close relationship between poverty and inequality on the one hand and poor mental health on the other, and that this relationship is bidirectional, that perhaps this time round, the response will be much more positive, and that we might realize actually a historic opportunity to rebuild mental health care systems everywhere.
We can all hope that. Vikram, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim, and thanks very much for talking to me.
The paper is called Poverty, Depression and Anxiety, Causal Evidence and Mechanisms. The authors are Matthew Ridley, Gautam Rao, Frank Schilbach and Vikram Patel. And it is NBER Working Paper 27157 if you want to look it up that way. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. If you enjoyed it, subscribe on your podcast platform and you will never miss an episode. Or you can find past episodes at voxdev.org.